Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Siberia, its boundaries are vague on the map, but boy, is it there. A huge, snowy footprint on the map of Asia and on the Russian mind. Famously vast and a puzzle. Crumbling gulags and dead industrial towns, and a huge swath of earth and nature, trees, rivers, wildlife, steppe, and tundra. New Yorker writer and humorist Ian Fraser fell in love with it and still isn't sure why. After many trips, many years and miles, he's written a big book about it. This hour on Point, Ian Fraser and Travels in Siberia. You can join the conversation. Have you seen Siberia? What did you see? What's your image of Siberia? Your question for Ian Fraser. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Wichita, Kansas, is Ian Fraser, writer, humorist, a frequent contributor to the New Yorker magazine, remembered for books like Great Plains and On the Res. His new book is called Travels in Siberia. Ian Fraser, welcome.
Thank you.
I remember reading chunks of this in the New Yorker, where you're getting ready to drive cross-country, in effect, across Siberia, getting your van together, getting your posse together, and off he would go. How much time, how widely have you traveled in Siberia, Ian?
Well, I made 5 trips there. They were of varying length. The trip that you're referring to was about 6.5 weeks, and with 2 Russian guides, I drove from St. Petersburg to Vladivostok. We drove about 15,000 kilometers, which is about 10,000 miles.
Wow.
And that was my longest trip. I also made trips of a month to other parts of Siberia. I went to Yakutsk in the middle of the winter. That was a month-long trip. I went to Baikal a couple of times, Lake Baikal, and I also went to Chukotka, which is the part of Siberia that's directly across from Alaska. It's like the Rorschach blot double of Alaska, just across the border. So I went to a lot of places there and covered a lot of miles there.
We had that kind of a tinkly little, almost jolly Mussorgsky music at the top.
Right.
But this is not jolly territory, and its history is not jolly. And its visage, I mean, the way Russians look at it is not jolly. And yet you've gone again and again. You chose to drive from St. Petersburg to Vladivostok. Why?
Well, it's a challenge. I mean, it's someplace that people have traveled for centuries. There's a very strong genre of Siberian travel books, and one that I'm proud to participate in. And I wanted to see what it was like. I was following one particular traveler, a famous 19th century traveler named George Kennan, not to be confused with the
diplomat,
Cold War strategist George Kennan, who was the original George Kennan's first cousin twice removed. Those two Kennans sometimes are confused, but the 19th century Kennan went on a big trip to see Siberian prisons in 1884 and wrote a great book about it called Siberia and the Prison Exile System. And he happened to be from the same town that my family's from in Ohio. I had always idolized this guy.
Wow.
Chekhov admired him. So I wanted to see, you know, what this Ohio guy did that was so great and that won the admiration of Russians.
We're going to look at the land itself and the people there now, but Siberia, you write right off the bat, is more than geography, especially for Russians. I mean, the word is infused with so much. How do Russians look out, in their case, to the east?
Well, people who live in Moscow and St. Petersburg, I found, were very skeptical about the idea of traveling there and very negative in their general view of what this place was, quite understandably, because it was a place you didn't want to be sent to and you didn't want to end up. In Siberia itself, I found people who liked living there. It's a nice it's a different way of life in many ways from life in Russian cities. And it's, it's just like living out in some big open place here. You know, you have space, I think people are friendlier. I think it's You're a little more independent. So there are some good qualities to it, and it depends on where in Russia you live, how you look at Siberia. In general, the view is, I would say, negative.
I mean, it's funny. In many ways, they use it in the same way that people here use it. You know, if you're seated in Siberia, I mean, you
right.
write about in classrooms, if teachers are thinking about the kids way in the back who rarely contribute and they call on them suddenly, they'll call on Kamchatka, as in the far, far, far eastern big peninsula there.
Right. And Kamchatka, by the way, is something I mention a lot because people in America tend to know where Kamchatka is just because of the Risk board game. People my age.
Sure. Yakutsk.
Right. You had to jump across. To get across the Pacific, you had to go to Kamchatka. So, and it's actually apparently a nice part of Siberia. I've never been to Kamchatka itself.
I was jealous. Spent a lot of time in Alaska. Jealous of you coming in across that small pass from Alaska. What's that like? What's the terrain up there where these two continents nearly meet?
It's tundra on both sides. And it's just white, I mean, in the winter, it's just white, bare hills, really. We might see a few dots on the hills, and that's a reindeer herd. But it's extremely windy and cold. The Bering Strait is quite forbidding. Very tough to pass across it in a boat or on skis, as some people have tried to do, and some people have succeeded.
How many miles, as Sarah Palin looked across that strait, how many miles apart are these two landmasses?
Well, I think it's like the actual distance, something like 43 miles, something mm-hmm. like that. But mm-hmm. you can, on a clear day, see both Alaska and Siberia, and it's just a glorious feeling. My question for Sarah Palin is, when did she actually see Russia? Because it took me 5 trips to Nome, Alaska, which is close,
right.
before the weather was good enough.
Right,
you know, I just would go up and get completely socked in, and then I'd have to come home. And finally, I did get up and in a helicopter and go to the Diomede Islands, which are in the strait.
Right. Well, she was governor of Alaska. Maybe, I don't know, maybe she had more time to gaze across there.
I'll bet she did have an actual opportunity to do it. But she can't see it from her house, I can guarantee you.
Talk to us about dimensions, what this is, where this is, its scale. I mean, you say straight up early on, nobody has ever formally laid out the boundaries of the actual physical Siberia.
Right. It's, as you said in the intro, it's 8 time zones. So America from Maine to California is 4 time zones. Interstate 80 from Teaneck, New Jersey to San Francisco is about half the length of the Trans-Siberian Railway. So it is, the scale is outsized, and if you're used to the big sky in America, Russia has a bigger sky, and there are times where you're just sort of steamrollered by this space. You don't know really even how to respond to it. I, at one point in my book, I say, you're in a such and such a place, it's like you're in the farthest section of the parking lot. If you can imagine like a mall parking lot that goes on, and why would anybody ever park there?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, you get to a place where there's no frame of reference, really, for the geography you're seeing. But I find that exhilarating. You know, it's a different kind of wilderness, like a wilderness of space.
Three-fourths of Russia today,
right.
Siberia, absolutely vast. And give us those boundaries. They may not be careful, but everybody knows them, the Urals on
right.
the west. And take us on right on around.
Well, they're the Ural Mountains on the west, which are a very low mountain range. You can drive over them and not know.
Mm-hmm.
On the south, there's the boundary of Kazakhstan, Mongolia, and China, although that is not a firm boundary because the actual landform continues beyond it. On the east, it's the Pacific Ocean, and that's a huge and long boundary. Just to get from Vladivostok up to Chukotka takes a long, long time. And then the northern boundary is the Arctic Ocean, and that boundary used to just be solid ice year-round. Now, with the warmer temperatures, ships are making that passage along the northern coast of Siberia, which is really an amazing new development. But basically, it's between, you know, those very large geographic areas, this enormous place, is considered to be in between those boundaries.
An enormous place to go, and for much of history, an enormous place to fear. Across the South, you remind us, it's mostly steppe. And you write,
right.
Out of the steppe in the 13th century came Genghis Khan and the Mongol horde, civilization's then worst nightmare. The wicked stepfathers of the Russian state and of its czars and commissars. Wicked stepfathers?
Oh, yeah. One of my pursuits in this book is to figure out why I like this country, why I have such a passion for it, when it really is in many ways an awful country. I call it the greatest horrible country in the world. And one of the conclusions I came to is that during the time when European countries were developing institutions like a market economy and representative government, or more or less representative, Russia was beset by Mongols. The Mongols invaded in 1243 and pretty much crushed Russia for another several hundred years after that. So my conclusion was that Russia was an abused country, like an abused child. In its childhood, it was abused by these wicked stepfathers, the Mongols, who kind of came, plundered, destroyed, ruled, and then receded back into the steppes and disappeared as a threat. But during the time that they were powerful, they really affected the way Russian institutions began. And even to this day, the kind of brutality of the Mongols is something that I sense, you know, runs through Russian history right up to the present.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Siberia with the big writer who's been there again and again. Ian Fraser's new book is Travels in Siberia. He joins us today from Wichita, Kansas. You know, we should paint some pictures for us. I think a lot of people, when they think of Siberia, we know it's more complicated, but there's this kind of generic view. It's, I don't know, huddled huts or prison barracks in this vast, grim sea of white or gray. What does it look like?
Well, it's somewhat varied as a landscape. In western Siberia, it's very swampy, and also in some other parts of Siberia. Mm-hmm. Siberian rivers drain north, which means that when they thaw upstream, and they're still frozen downstream, so the water backs up.
Yeah.
Siberia has the largest swamps in the world. And that's more characteristic of the western part of Siberia. As you get farther east, you have steppe, you have taiga, which is the Russian, the Siberian forest, and that stretches, you know, 3,600 miles across Siberia and continues all the way really to Finland, and it's the largest forest in the world, and it's again a kind of daunting place. I've walked in it, and it's not like there are trails. You know, you kind of go into it and then you're just in this enormous woods. So it's also can be quite monotonous. A great Russian traveler, the Marquis de Custine, in the 19th century said that monotony is the divinity of Russia. And what you get is you cross it, you get a kind of almost test pattern feeling. I don't know, you can almost be lulled to sleep. And a lot of the physical architecture of it is quite similar from one place to the next. I mean, the Soviets just built the same thing over and over and over all the way across their country. So you see the same kind of bridges and the same kind of high-rises and the same kind of fences. And there's also a very, you know, one-size-fits-all sort of Soviet approach to things that's still there.
The U.S. has its west, its golden west. Russia has its east, its Siberia. You know, you can imagine we might look at them similarly, and yet it's very clear in your book that we don't. Paint that difference in perspective.
Well, we ride off into the sunset in the west. You know, we have a western view that's basically a happy view or a hopeful view. For Russia, to look east is much more ambiguous in terms of what's going to come out of there. The Mongols came out of there, or you might be sent there. The way that I've kind of contrasted it is that America, as we go west, we're constantly pursuing a mirage. It's like a perpetual mirage.
For the golden dream.
Russians, and it's a dream. And Siberia is closer to a nightmare. It's not exclusively that, because there was, Siberia is very rich in resources. It was a place where people went and homesteaded, just as we did in the American West. It was a place where serfs were no longer serfs. Serfdom stopped at the Urals, so that when you got east of the Urals, you were no longer a serf. So there were hopeful aspects to it as well, but it's a much more ambiguous feeling than we have for our American West.
You make it very tactile. You write in Travels in Siberia about the smell of Russia, the smell of Siberia. You say there's a lot of diesel fuel in it, and cucumber peels, and old tea bags, and sour milk, and a sweetness, currant jam or mulberries crushed into the waffle treads of heavy boots, and fresh wet mud, and a lot of wet cement, and visually a lot of trash.
Surprisingly, yeah. Russians are not big on, putting all
tidying
the trash.
Up.
They don't tidy up. I mean, I think it's maybe how we used to feel about our West, that there's so much of it, what would a little trash hurt, But along the mainly, the heavily traveled part of Siberia, which basically parallels the Trans-Siberian Railway, there is just a lot of trash, and they're not trash barrels. You just see it. Sometimes there will be trash everywhere, and then there will be a whole bunch of trash in one place. I don't know why they just decided to put a whole bunch of trash there when there's already trash everywhere else. But I also realized after my winter trip that it might not be such a problem if you're only seeing this, 4 months out of the year. If it's covered with snow the rest of the year, what's the big deal?
We'll come to the camps. You do get to them, what remains of them. We've got a lot of callers for you. Ian Fraser's new book is Travels in Siberia. Joanna in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Joanna.
Hi.
Hi. What do you know?
I have a story about a time that I was in Siberia in May of 2006, and three friends and I rode the Trans-Siberian Railway. We were in the east teaching, or in the western part of Russia teaching, and we went out to Lake Baikal, and we wanted to go to Okhon Island, which is on the lake. And in the summer, there's a ferry that goes there, and there in the winter, there's an ice road. But it was May, and the ice was too thin for the ice for people to be driving across on cars, but there was too much ice for the ferry. And so we had contacted a sort of resort on the island, if you can call it that, and they said they would get us to the island. And so we got dropped off at the edge of the lake, and they came across on a motorcycle with a sidecar across the ice and loaded us up on there. And it was very harrowing. We almost fell through the ice in a couple places, I think. And when we got to the island, everyone told us that we were crazy for for getting across there, but we had a great time.
I love the story. Ian, you talked about the divinity of it, monotony, but it can get harrowing in a hurry.
Well, I went on not that particular ice road, but I went on an ice road on Lake Baikal, and the ice cracks, and there will be just these big cracks, and you come up to it in your car, and you look down, and there's water. It's like water sloshing out of it. And the way they fix it is by putting pieces of carpet over the crack and then pouring a whole bunch of water on that carpet until they built a sort of ice bridge with the base of this on the base of this piece of carpet, and then they drive over that. There's just a much more relaxed sense of what is safe and what is unsafe in Russia. We are obsessed with safety. Russians will laugh at you for putting on a seatbelt. They just consider safety beneath their notice. So it is funny the way they'll deal with things that would scare you to death. And they go, oh, no, we just drive over on this little piece of carpet and ice.
About safety and the threat of the cold itself and the way you saw Siberians living with that?
Well, they're very used to cold, and I think the people who have been there a long time actually like it. When it gets really, really cold, it's everything changes. In America, usually you have thaws. In Siberia, that snow is there. It's there all winter, and it becomes a substance like concrete, mm-hmm. And you're walking on it, it squeaks. I mean, When I was in Yakutsk, it was just 40 degrees below zero regularly. Mm-hmm. And you'd go out and it was just like walking on cement. And then coming into a Russian building in a very far northern place like that, where you get this blast of Russian diesel smell and this great warmth, it's a combination of kind of, you know, you're not so sure this is good for you, but really great comfort.
And I know that squeak of that extreme cold.
Oh, yeah.
Nashville, Tennessee. Larry, you're on with Ian Frazier.
Hi, Tom. I was in Siberia actually videotaping what was supposed to be a bear hunt.
What part of Siberia, Larry? Where were you exactly?
I went to the landing spot out there was a place called Tomsk, T-O-M-S-K.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, that was our departure. Once we arrived in Siberia, we were met by some people who were interested in trying to promote American hunters coming to Siberia for hunting. And so I was fortunate. I was in Moscow videotaping another event, and the travel people hooked me up with the Russian travel agency type people. And so we landed in Tomsk and took automobiles through the night to a place to where the automobiles wouldn't run anymore. And then we got on snowmobiles and traveled another 8 or 10 hours or so and arrived at a little 8x10 hut way up there. I'm not sure how far we were, but we were way up there.
Larry, Tomsk is down Kazakhstan way. What was the terrain like around there where you were snowmobiling?
It was generally a flat area. You know, I don't remember any mountains or hills or anything like that. All I remember is I got very tired of being on the back end of a snowmobile.
And what about the bears? We're going to have people cringing and people all the rest.
That's funny. And, you know, it's a winter time, so I'm not, you know, how are we going to find a bear in the snow, you know? They'll be hibernating. Well, their technique was to use dogs, and where they saw the snow indentations over snow caves, that's how they located bears.
And then shoot a sleeping bear.
Well, no. Hey, I'm telling you, I think that the bear hunt was sort of a publicity idea that somebody on either side or their side came up with. But in effect, they had no intention of shooting a bear. Actually, there was a fellow from California that was the hunter, and I was the videotape guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And up there, they had taken a contingency of Russians with us. It was about 19 people, and you know, cooks, and they took a diesel engine to fire my batteries, to recharge my battery. I mean, it was a well organized event.
But no bear at the end, I guess.
No bear. They finally shot what they told me was an elk, but I promise you, you know, there was a language barrier.
Boy, I mean, it's hard to picture, and yet it sounds like you just may have been taken for a little bit of a ride, a snowmobile ride. Ian Frazier, what do you make of Larry's story?
Well, that sounds familiar. I mean, I was taken for things that I would categorize as rides, but I did not see wildlife very much. I mean, I never saw a bear in Siberia. I never saw an elk. There were tigers in the very far east, not in the vicinity of Vladivostok. And I was staying with a woman, and I said, "Have you ever seen a tiger?" And she said, "Yeah, I have." I said, "Where?" And she said, "It walked down my street." And she had taken a photograph of it.
Oh, my gosh.
And there was a tiger, like, walking down the street of this village of Olga on the Pacific in north of Vladivostok. And it was like there was something wrong with the tiger. But there, you know, Russians are not real careful with their natural resources. And game laws do not really seem to obtain there. So that people, they're very... the wildlife, I think, in general, in the places where people are, is degraded, and you don't see much of it. And what you do see, you know, I saw millions of pike, little tiny pike, in rivers there, but I didn't see other kinds of fish. You know, it was rather unvaried in terms of fish and birds and stuff like that.
Vera, Norwich, Connecticut. Vera, you're on with Ian Frazier.
Yes, hi. I was privileged to be able to go to Russia, but it was quite a number of years ago when it was still the former Soviet Union. And it's my dream to return, but this time to go to Siberia. So I'm very anxious to get your book. But what draws me to Siberia specifically is the fact of how conceptually it evokes imagery of the wilderness of the medieval Desert Fathers of Christianity. And I'm interested in visiting and knowing about sacred places, sacred landscapes, or sacred fastnesses that would be either sacred to the traditional tribal people of Siberia, or, and in addition to that, perhaps outposts of the Russian Orthodox Church, maybe monasteries. And I'm wondering if you touch on this in your book.
Let us ask, Ian. Thanks.
Yeah, I do touch on it some. Russian spirituality kind of receded into the wilderness during times of difficulty in the Russian state. The Mongol era is one. People just kind of moved off into monasteries and churches that were way out in the woods. And you can find those in Siberia. They did not do well during the Soviet period. So some are preserved as museums in Novosibirsk, or near Novosibirsk, which is right in the middle of Siberia. It's the largest city in Siberia and an easy place to get to. There is a preserved church that was much, much farther north in Siberia on the Indigirka River that they brought down and completely reassembled. And it's very interesting. And I go into that a lot. As for native spiritual sites, I didn't really see like a lot of them, but there were places where people that I was with would just get out and pray. One thing that people do in Siberia is when they come to the top of a hill, they get out and they tear a little piece off a garment that they're wearing and they tie that piece of cloth to a branch of a tree right there, or a bush. And so you come to these places where there's just thousands and thousands of little pieces of cloth tied to the trees and the bushes. And everybody stops. Sometimes they drop a coin on the ground, and then you go on down the other side of the hill. And I always enjoyed those places too. But there are lots of there are monasteries, and there's still a number of churches that you can visit if you find a guidebook.
I remember some pretty tough stories about the tribal people, the Sami people in the north. We talked with someone who had written about them, I don't know, a while back. And I mean, the Soviets were brutal. Like they had their mythology about flying, and said the Soviets would take them up and toss them out of helicopters and say, "Show us now how you can fly with your reindeer. Off you go."
Yeah, this has been, I mean, during that period, the idea was, you know, you're going to collectivize reindeer farming, for example, which is just reindeer raising, which is kind of a bizarre idea. And those collective reindeer farms have also fallen on pretty hard times since the Soviet period.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Siberia with Ian Frazier, who's been there again and again, New Yorker writer, written Great Plains and On the Res, and much more this time. His big book is Travels in Siberia, many thousands of miles, tens of thousands, over many years, many different trips, and he brings it all together in one big volume. Lots of response online. Ian, here's Paul, who says, "I love Siberia, mostly flat, lot of birch trees. All along the route of the Trans-Siberian Railroad, from end to end, I saw farmers decked out in Adidas tracksuits." Not exactly history. "Irkutsk and Ulan-Ude on Lake Baikal were lovely, although Irkutsk was experiencing the early stages of a heroin epidemic." It's not all human loveliness by any means out there, Ian.
Right, yeah. And he's very much right about those tracksuits. When I was there, the tracksuit was kind of the basic thing that you saw guys wearing, certainly guys, you know. Yeah, I didn't see, you know, I saw just a little bit of that drug problem that Siberia has. And you see, of course, a lot of drinking. But that's anywhere in Russia you see that. But yeah, it's it is varied, you know, as you go across. The birch trees are one of the constant things all the way across. So you can see why Russians have this sort of romantic feel for birch trees.
Your crew on the big transcontinental drive was very unkeen on visiting the old gulags, the old concentration camps or prison barracks there. Why? And when you finally got to one, what did you find?
Well, I think, I'm not sure why, I think it was maybe out of, you know, partly out of pride and partly out of reluctance to be criticized by someone from a foreign country. I mean, I've felt it, you know, in America when I'll see someone from some other country, you know, look at me askance, like at a place, say, Wounded Knee out mm-hmm. west, where Americans did something bad, and so I could see they didn't really like my accusatory, you know, glance if I was doing that.
But around much of the world, the gulags are maybe the best known fact about Siberia. It's almost
absolutely
a synonym for gulag.
Right. Yeah. And it was a place. It was a The entire area of Siberia was closed during the Soviet times. And there were places of such remoteness that it's hard even sort of to describe where they are. And then you'd find this gulag camp there. And what I ended up doing was going north of Yakutsk. I went along a river valley where in Stalin times, there had been this attempt to build a road north to the Arctic Circle from there, mm-hmm. and it was built totally by prison laborers. And so finally I did find these camps along this road, and they had been abandoned for 50 years. But this is in a permafrost zone. It's in a place where there's snow on the ground 8 months of the year. And so they were kind of preserved. It was like they'd been flash frozen and just kept. So we went to these one particular camp and walked around in it, and it was as spooky as you might imagine. And it called forth all kinds of associations, and it was almost too much. It was a big moment in the book, and I only really went around and walked around in one camp. I saw others from the road, but actually going in and checking out the barracks and going through the barbed wire and, you know, looking at the guard towers and that type of thing, I only really did that once.
Mm, brutality, kind of overwhelming. You could see how they'd tried to fill in the gaps between the logs of the cabins with moss. Jonas, mm-hmm. in Boston. Jonas, you're on the air with Ian Fraser.
Hi, Tom. When I think of this, Siberia, how it affected my family and my Lithuanian nationality, it's pure Russia had created hell on earth. For these people. My father's cousin was deported to Siberia because her husband was a policeman. His name also was Jonas, who I was named after.
Mm-hmm.
And she then, when the Soviets came back in 1944, when they reoccupied Lithuania, she was deported to Siberia with her three children, the 9, 6, and 2. They were sent to Siberia. She escaped and brought her children back into Lithuania. She was caught again under the Soviet regime. She was deported a second time. And she spoke of like how they were just abandoned in the first year. They just collected moss because that was the only thing that was still not frozen as of yet because of the ground is permafrost. And they made stacks and huts where they lived. And then the following year they came back, and the Russians said to them, "We'll see who's here in spring." Meaning whoever survived, the hundreds of them that were left. So the handful that were survived, then they huddled together and they chopped down the birches. They made huts and built into the ground, cracked the ice, and built their huts deep into the ground so that there was only the roof that mm-hmm. actually was on the top. And then they survived. She traveled back. What my other, her second cousin, my also cousin, he was a member of a Catholic organization when he was in college, but that was before the Soviet occupation, and all of their laws were retroactive. So he was deported to Siberia. When Stalin died, he was told he submitted a release from prison from his 20 years, and because he insulted the Soviets for accusing them of illegally sending him there, he was given another 20. And so in 1984, after 40 years in Siberia, I was a student in the Lithuanian University,
mm-hmm.
and he came back that year, and he described to minute detail the brutality, the hatred. When we say it was built with slave labor, it was slave labor, children labor, and it was in I don't know how to say it in Russian, but in Lithuania they said "pigiau negukuta." It's cost less than a bullet, meaning your life is
yeah.
less than the kopeck that this bullet cost.
Yeah.
You know, and the shivers still go through my spine. And we thought in the United States, after my family left the occupation, we thought that Veronica had died. And it was only when I went to the Lithuanian Genocide Museum that I mentioned about her, and I wanted to find out where she had died, and someone said, no, she's back in Lithuania. And only 4 years ago, we were reestablished with my cousins and second cousins and their children. But all of those four children, the three children that were deported to Siberia, they all died. Veronica is now 99 years old. She's alive. But because they were so malnutrition, they all died.
Jonas, I appreciate you're bringing the reality of this to us, you know, so personally and vividly. I mean, it's almost stupefying to hear that litany. The hell, it must still be seen as a hell on earth in your family. You're not talking about long ago, Jonas. You're talking about...
I go every year to visit. You know, it's so funny because when Lithuania declared itself again independent to Gorbachev when he was visiting, they said, we're going to become independent. And he said, how are you going to become independent? And they said, we'll sing our way to independence because we won't raise our hand against you like you did to us. And so Lithuania sent all of its students from the university and from the colleges and everything else, and they went to Siberia and they dug up all the graves that they could find of their own people, and they brought them back to Lithuania, and they said to Gorbachev, see, now we want nothing to do with you. We brought back our dead. Now go away.
Jonas, I appreciate your call. Ian Fraser, how does a land, a people deal with that kind of legacy, that kind of hell on earth legacy? How does it breathe in Siberia now or chill it?
Well, Russia's finding that out. I mean, it is a complicated thing. It is not heartening to know that a recent public opinion poll trying to determine who Russians thought were the greatest Russians of all time. On that poll, Stalin came in third behind Alexander Nevsky and Pyotr Stolypin, who was a government minister under Nicholas, the last Tsar. So Stalin came in third, and I think Lenin came in like fifth or sixth. So it is a tough legacy, and it's not one that only Russia has to deal with, because now, Stalin was our ally. One thing I found out as I was doing the research was that Stalin appeared on the cover of Time magazine 11 times.
Those were not all laudatory appearances.
Oh, well, mostly, yeah. It was like, you know, I mean, I didn't look at each individual one to see whether it was laudatory. But basically, Stalin was, you know, Uncle Joe. He was our ally, and, you know, we had to work with him. And what I also was amazed by was that there were prison-built cities, like the city of Providenia, which is in Chukotka. And that's a, you know, 70-minute plane ride from America, from Nome, Alaska.
Right, way up
so
north.
So there were these prisoner-built places that were really a stone's throw from our border, and it is kind of incredible to think how close some of this was to America.
Jonas talked about Lithuanians going back, but you note that there's very few marker or memorials to the whole Gulag system. It's as though it's not marked, not in the way that, I don't know, Auschwitz or Dachau have been.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know of other places. I know of no place in Siberia where there is a memorial or where there is a Gulag, former Gulag camp that's been made into some kind of memorial or a museum. And what really amazed me as I stood and looked at this permanently frozen gulag camp in the Russian far north was that there were no markers of any kind. There was no sign. There was no writing. There was nothing. So that you were left only to imagine the people who had been here and who had died here. And the people who had built these bridges, the bridges over these little creeks were made out of stones and logs. The only thing they brought from Western Russia or from only manufactured thing would be like the nails that held the logs together. And everything else was from that place, wrenched from the land by prisoners who worked there and built into these amazing structures, very well-engineered structures. But who were the engineers that designed that? Who were the prisoners that did this work, cut down the trees and put these bridges together? You know, you're only left to imagine who those people were.
Ian Frazier's new book is Travels in Siberia. Let's go to Jan in Boston. Jan, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. You know, I read the articles in the New Yorker, and one of the things I really liked was the way you captured the Russians talking about themselves. They'd say, this is my dacha, this is my car. And I just thought that was really spot on. I had lived in Ukraine for 2 years in the early 90s. I was working there. And I was going to relate one of my experiences. I decided to go mountain biking around Lake Baikal, which I'm not exactly sure why I did it. But you know how the roads just end. Well, there I was on the Trans-Siberian right-of-way, and I just flew off, hit a steel beam, landed about on a large rock. And they eventually got me to the hospital. And just some of the details about it, I mean, the ambulance had a plastic chair that was bolted down to the floor, and that's all they had in the ambulance. When they got me to the hospital, and they didn't have any ice because they didn't have any refrigeration. And the kind of the what was turned out to be funny was the doctor wanted to stitch me up, and I said, oh, no, 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 because I was concerned about how sterile the needles would be. Mm-hmm. Well, my Russian wasn't very good at the time. And she finally came back in the room with her embroidery and showed it to me. And thinking that, I thought she wasn't going to do a good job of stitching me.
Look at my embroidery. Come on.
That is great. That
is, so we finally negotiated really it down. And I'm sure you know, at least at that time, the only thing you could ever get in terms of U.S. currency were $100. So all I had was $100. And I gave her $100 for two disposable needles. And she used one in the that day, and she gave me a shot of Novocaine. I'd broken five ribs, and my lung had collapsed. And then the next morning, I went in, and she used the other needle for the other shot of Novocaine.
So you did get fixed up in the end. Is it as pretty as your embroidery?
Actually, she didn't stitch me up.
Oh,
we talked about doing butterfly bandages, and it healed up quite nicely.
Oh, boy, Janet, we're glad you survived. Thanks so much, Ian. The Russians talking about themselves. Fill us in there. You and Jan seem to get that, but I'm not sure. This is my dacha. This is my car. What's that?
Well, I mean, just when I first went there, and then actually also on later trips, the Russians were converting sort of to capitalism, and they wanted to show how they had done. You know, they were doing pretty good so far. So this was, she's referring to a guy who showed me around his summer house outside of the city of Vologda, and everything he had, you know, it was like... you know, I said, what is that house over there? This guy was a bottler of mineral water. And I said, he was in this sort of compound. And I said, what is that house over there, that little house? And he said, oh, that's for my bodyguards. And then, you know, he showed me his guns. And, you know, it was like, look how we're doing. And at one point, he wanted to bottle some lime mineral water, lime flavored. And he said, you know, you're an American. Tell me what kind of bottle should I put it in?
Is this the same guy that when he finally got the lights on in his kitchen and all lit up very bright, he said,
right,
America.
He goes, ah, America, when all the lights came
lights
on after he fixed the lights. And that to me is like an analogy to, you know, it's similar to, you know, Siberia as a concept, America as a concept, only it's a concept brightly lit in the mind of this particular guy. So it's certainly more hopeful.
Does Siberia end up a grim concept to you then, or something hopeful budding, or which? What?
I think it is. I mean, the land itself is neutral. It's what we put on it, what human beings have put on it, that give it whatever character it has. And I have to say, I sort of feel sorry for the land itself because it's just like any other place on Earth. You know, it has its good and bad points, and there are things that it can provide people that are amazing. I mean, it's got more mineral wealth than practically anywhere else on Earth, for example. So that it's this place that, in its own way, it's just sitting there, and it's what we project on it that gives it this character. It doesn't think of itself as Siberia if it's not going too far to characterize it as a sentient being. It doesn't think of itself as, you know, some horrible, far-flung place.
Well, a lot of those projections have been pretty rough. Let's hope that they somehow get better. It's a great tour, and you've really put in the time to bring it back in great detail and insight. Ian Fraser's new book is Travels in Siberia. Ian, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Listeners, you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. You can continue the conversation there as well. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Alina Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Marika Spence, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us. Но может все сложиться по-другому, и долгой утомленная пургой, ты, может быть, уедешь жить к другому.